We're doing the Ramban, Torah Hashem Tmima. We're up to page Zayin in the Chazon Yoel edition, page Chaf Chet in the Beit Hayayin edition. The Ramban had said, V'chashov b'libcha she'akadosh baruch hu barak ol ha'shfalim la'ana'ato shel adam le'tashmisho. Think about the concept that all of the creatures created in the world, other than man, were created to service man for his benefit. For we have no other reason for the creation of other creatures, plants, animals. They don't recognize their creator. So why were they created? What purpose do they serve? They're there to serve man who serves his creator. And we discussed last time that there's a whole philosophy in this sentence. We discussed the Ibn Ezra, we discussed the Mishnah in Kiddushin, that all of earth was created to service man. We discussed the applications of that philosophy and the questions we would have on that, and whether the Ramban means that completely, because what about man who does not have the intellect to perceive his creator? Why was he created? So we asked questions and we expanded on this last time. That's where we left off. Man was created with a responsibility to recognize his creator, blessed be he. And if man says, I don't know who created me at all, and certainly if man doesn't recognize that the creator says there are actions which are chosen, there are actions which are desirable, and then there are actions which are abhorred. There are actions that should be distanced from one. If one doesn't recognize that, and through philosophy, one can really blur the lines. A person can say, there is no ethic. How can you prove that morality is right? What is wrong? I can understand that saying 1 plus 1 equals 3 is wrong. But how can you explain why murder is wrong? You don't like it? Who says what you don't like is wrong? Meaning philosophically, a person can blur the lines. And notice how the Ramban is gently assuming a whole philosophy, the idea that the connection between right and wrong is intimately connected with the idea of a creator who gave us guidance in the world. So he began, in one sentence, he fluidly passed from the idea that man does not recognize his creator at all, to man who does not recognize that the creator has defined actions which are positive and actions which are negative. Nimtza. Zeha adam kabeima. So then that man is no different than an animal. The kavanat briato batla, and then his purpose of existence has ceased. V'zeu shamu chazal tamid sheilu lo kiblu Yisrael ta Torah yamachzir olam letov vavo. That's what our sages repeatedly pointed out, that if we would not have accepted the Torah, Hashem would have said, okay, we're done with the world, there's no point. Meaning, if mankind would not desire to know and to learn the intimate connection with their Creator, that's point one. And notice how the Ramban keeps the two connected. And that Hashem has defined for us that He says this is good and this is evil, and there's a difference. So then the whole purpose of creation has been annulled. So the Ramban here is assuming a whole philosophy. We have to know our Creator, and that knowledge has to lead us to a recognition of a positive and a negative action. It's not a free-for-all. It's not do as you see fit. Every person should create their own system. Today, plurality has led to a situation where there's so much respect. Someone told me this. He was serious. I don't know if this is factually true. He told me that if a person wants to board a plane with a pig, with a hog, the attendants cannot say no. Because just as a person is allowed to go on a plane with a seeing eye dog, so people have claimed that they need their cats for emotional stability. And if you don't let them board the plane with their cat, then they will not be emotionally stable. So that's that's considered discrimination. And then other people said they need their other pet animals. And he told me, I don't know about this legally, but he claims that legally today, they cannot tell a person no boarding the plane with this animal or that animal, because people have sued that they need this animal or that animal to be with them on the plane. So there's no border, fine. He needs it, that's legitimate. And if we keep broadening the spectrum of what's legitimate, so the courts today are upholding that people can marry, a man can marry a man, a woman can marry a woman, and that's going to be called a family in many states. It's already called a family in many states. So there's a blurring of the lines. Suddenly, there's no clear definition. Dr. Kevorkian can put people to death, and legally that's okay in some states. So you start blurring the lines. People can call it abortion in the eighth month. Wait, the baby could live without the mother. There's a baby there. The baby can grasp your hand if you put your finger in his hand. The baby has reflexes. The baby has feelings. But many states and countries will call that abortion. So where do you draw the line of where does it become murder, and where do you call it abortion? So comes the Torah and tells us, if there's a Ribbono Shel Olam, he also told you what's right and what's wrong. It goes hand in hand, and we say that every day in Kriyat Shema. The Mishnah in Brachos says, Lama kadema shma livayim shamoa. Why did our sages institute that we first read Shema and then the paragraph of Vayayim Shamoa? They're both written in two separate parshios, right? Shema is written in Parshas Vayeschanan, Vayayim Shamoa is written in Parshas Ekev. How do you know what order to read them in? Our sages say, Shemitchila mekabel lavol malchut shamayim. First, the person has to accept the yoke of heaven. There is a creator. He's in charge here. And then mekabel lavol mitzvot. Then a person from that automatically understands, I have a responsibility to adhere to the system that he told me. This is right, this is wrong. This is praiseworthy, this is abominable. You'd ask me what's abominable about certain things that the Torah says are abominable? I don't know. Can logic really explain why certain things are abominable? I don't know. I don't have the logic for it. But the Torah gives us a system. You know, the world has basically accepted that incest is wrong. Now, what's the logic behind that? Why is it okay when a person marries a woman outside his family, but improper when he marries his own sister? Why? Where's that logical? I don't have sisters, so I have no idea what a person feels towards their sister. Never had a sister. We're all boys in my family. But
now you can marry your brother in some states.
Thank you. Comes the Torah and sets up a system and tells us this is right, this is wrong. And the Ramban says the two are connected. There's a creator, he defines for us what's right and wrong. Now, here we really should expand. You guys want to take 15 minutes to discuss this concept?
Yes.
It's a basic concept in Jewish philosophy, in philosophy at large. Okay, so our story begins with the Puritans. You guys heard of the Puritans? Yes. They came, they were being persecuted in England, so they came to the United States and they started settling the United States. And they eventually rebelled against England and developed the United States as a separate country, right? Now, everyone thinks of them as freedom fighters. These were people who wrote the Declaration of Independence and then the Constitution. So, founding fathers of the United States. But it was also commonly accepted in those times, that women had no intellect. A woman couldn't own land. Why should a woman be allowed to own land? What do they know? They're like children. That was the obvious approach. And of course, if a child misbehaves, you beat him. And of course, if your wife misbehaves, you beat her. What question is there? It was common practice. You guys know where the word rule of thumb comes from? Because the rule was, you can't beat her with a stick that's thicker than a thumb. That's not right to beat your wife with a stick thicker than a thumb. But less than the thickness of a thumb was considered okay. So we have to ask ourselves, wait, are we more ethical than they were? Why? They would look at us and say, we're crazy. We look at them and say, how ethical were they? They had slaves. They didn't give women rights. You know, if a man was upset at his wife, the Puritans had a stock in the middle of the town where he could put his wife for half a day, and they had a special clip he would put on her tongue, and she would have to stay there with her tongue stuck out, and it was a way of punishing her for talking too much. So this was legal practice in the United States. Ethical? So today we look at that, and a person would be put behind bars for behaving that way. But you know what? Up until the turn of the century, in many countries, if a person was caught being interested in other men, he would also be put in an insane asylum. And in Russia, that's still the case till today. If it's known that a person is interested in other men, so then the assumption is there's something wrong with him, and he's put in an insane asylum against his will. What's ethical? We look at them and say they weren't ethical, but they thought they were ethical. Every generation thinks they're ethical. Every generation thinks they're at the cutting edge of ethics. So moral. So a few years ago, the subway was running, and a woman runs up to a train. This is Midtown Manhattan, and she tells the driver, a cat just ran into the tracks. You can't drive. And the driver says, lady, I got maybe 1,000 people in this train. And if I don't pull out of the station, there's another train waiting to come in and another train behind that. All these people have to get home from work. If I stay here 15 minutes, I have delayed not only my passengers 15 minutes, I can delay 500,000 people 15 minutes. And who's to say after 15 minutes they'll get the cat out? And the woman says, that's all very nice. If you move, I'm suing. And he says, what are you suing? She says, you can't mow over a cat just because you have to go. I saw a cat go down those tracks. And if you move the train, I'm suing you for the cruelty against the cat. He tells her, lady, I just told you 500,000 people are counting on my moving. And that's if I wait 15 minutes. The lady says, I'm going to sue. So the man says, what do I have to risk my job for? And he calls the supervisor and says, what do I do? And the supervisor says, what do I have to lose my job for? So he calls his manager. And the manager says, what do I have to lose my job for? So the train is standing at the stop. And it went up the chain of command. Because everyone realized that if this lady's for real, and she's going to sue, if she wins, and even if she doesn't, they might lose their job. So who wants to take responsibility for such a thing? This hit the news, because Midtown Manhattan, train stop, over 100,000 people are being delayed from picking up their kids from daycare, etc. People are stuck on the tracks. The train can't come to the station. Other people are stuck up the tracks in their trains. So it hit the news. And what happened was, for the next 2 days, all you heard about on the talk shows was a discussion of what was right and what was wrong. And you'd hear people vehemently argue, if all those 250,000 people got together and tried to create one cat, none of them could do it. And even if all of them worked the rest of their lives to create one cat, they couldn't bring it back. So how could you mow down a cat just because you're in a rush to pick up your kids? And other people would say, but it's a cat, and these are people. And there are children waiting. And the arguments went back and forth. And what was clear was that people had real opinions, and they felt very strongly that what they were saying was ethically correct. And although people could respect one another and could argue with one another, people had very strong beliefs on this matter. And when you listen to it, you realize that what was missing from this whole conversation was God. Because if we're going to each decide what's ethical, what's right, what's moral, well, we can come to different conclusions. And we're going to act based on those conclusions. So one person says, why do you have more of a right to life than the cat? And the next person says, because I'm a human being and she's a cat. And he says, so? So you see, the first person views man as a more sophisticated animal. The second person views man as something totally different. Why is man different? Are we merely a more sophisticated animal? Does our sophistication allow us to live? Because if that's the case, then what about when a person dies? Why don't we eat them? What's morally wrong with eating a dead body? Because it's unhealthy? So if it were healthy, then it would be morally correct? Why? Why don't we eat people? When people die, why don't we make a barbecue? And if the whole reason why man is entitled to eat animal is because man is more intellectual, so then we could kill retarded people? Is that what we're saying? So we come to it and say it has nothing to do with your intellect. Hashem gave us a Torah, and in the Torah Hashem revealed to us that man is different. There's godliness to every man. Man is holy. We treat man as sacred. When the man dies, we treat the body as sacred. We honor the body. We bury the body. We cherish the place where the person was buried. That's all because we have tremendous respect for the human being, because we see him as a representation of godliness. But if you have no Torah, so then look at eugenics. People have reached the conclusion that you could definitely kill people who are retarded. Not so long ago, people who were considered very ethical and moral. Then again, they also reached the conclusion that you could kill people who are black, because they're not too intelligent either, or at least so they thought. If it's all a question of intelligence, then where do you draw the line? Does the person with the highest IQ, does he get entitlement to eat people with lower IQs? Where do you draw the line? Because if man is merely a more sophisticated animal, so then how could you eat animals? So then you'll say, I won't eat animals. And the question is, today they've discovered that plants communicate too, and plants emit a very high-pitched sound when they're cut down. So now you can't eat plants either. What are you going to eat? Amoebas? Saying, well, what are you going to live off of? Can't eat anything. Water. Okay. Until we discover what's in the water. So when we don't have a system, the fact that a person thinks he's ethical and moral is really a questionable basis for action. Because I'm going to act based on what I think is moral and ethical, you'll act based on what you think is moral and ethical. And so if my conclusion happens to be that I'm allowed to eat you for dinner, that's my conclusion. Does that entitle me to do it? So we say no. We say every person, every human being has a God-given conscience. And every human being has a responsibility to delve into the question and analyze and search and ultimately discover that there is a creator and he has expectations of us. One of those expectations is thou shalt not kill. One of those expectations is that we have respect for the creator and we have respect for the human beings that he's created. We cannot steal. It's not only a question of survival of the fittest. If I'm going to go with evolution, so then let's take it to the umpteenth degree. If I can get away with it, let's say you're the president of North Korea, and you've discovered how you could hack every computer in the world and knock all the systems down, destroy all the systems, throw a few nuclear bombs and conquer the world. Survival of the fittest, why not? That's the way the world's been functioning. If we're looking to function in sync with nature, so then if I am the fittest, does that entitle me to devour everyone else? Why not? You guys know there's an author, Ayn Rand, that was her philosophy. That's how she led her life too. You know, when she found a married man who she was interested in, didn't interest her that he was married. So the story goes, I don't know her personally, but that's what they write about her, that she was happy taking someone else's wife because survival of the fittest. So there are not going to be too many limitations. You can develop your own limitations, but the next guy can develop theirs. Comes the Torah and says, no, there's a creator and he has expectations. It's not a free-for-all. And that's one of the most pivotal points which we have to understand about the Torah. That's the point that Ramban is alluding to here. The Torah and the idea that there is a creator is intimately connected with the concept that there is an action which is right and an action which is wrong, and it's not a free-for-all. We're not so open to say, do what you think is right. No, there's a real answer to the question of what's right and wrong. There is a connection between truth and falsehood, and good and bad. And it's not do as you see fit. The world today calls themselves liberal and accepting. I can accept that you respect something. Great. I heard a funny conversation between my kids today. They saw figurines made out of gold and silver. So they started asking me, are these idols? Do people worship these? So one of the kids said, no one would worship that. That's a piece of metal. So the other one says, what are you talking about? Just outside my school, there's a non-Jew who spreads out a cloth, I see him in the afternoon, and he bows to that cloth every afternoon. So I wasn't going to correct them. But it's just interesting to hear their perspective. So do I say free-for-all? He wants to bow to a cloth, let him bow to a cloth. Nothing wrong with that. Or do I say, no, there's everything wrong with that. There's a right, there's a wrong, and there's an ethical value we all have to live up to. And if you don't know it yet, you got to discover it. And if you think about it, what the Torah has given us is not only an opening, a glimpse into godliness, into what's the correct way of living the world, living our lives, the Torah has also given us a system which is the greatest gift to humanity. And that's why our sages say the Torah is the purpose of creation. It's not that every person has to spend every free minute learning Torah and the whole world should be one big kollel. Yes, ideally we want people to learn as much as possible. That's true. But the idea is that the impact of the Torah on the world. We were born into a generation where the world has really, really taken on many of the values of the Torah. But think about it, it's a new thing. Up until 100 years ago, there was hardly a country where a woman could own land. When the Torah says women can own land, when the Torah says a woman has a right and a man may not beat his wife, when the Torah says you have a biblical prohibition from saying something hurtful to your wife, when the Torah says that citizens have equal rights, when the Torah says that a convert is to be treated with extra care, those are unique concepts. They didn't exist anywhere in the world. For over a millennium after the Torah was given, you didn't find any culture that adopted these concepts. Today we're born into a world where much of the world has adopted Torah concepts. So it can be a little bit confusing, but let's look at the history of the world. The world, using its own presumptions of what was ethical and moral, felt very comfortable doing many unethical activities, including taking rights away from women, including beating women, which was a given. That was a given in most societies of the world. It's perfectly legitimate. In the Torah, it says it's a biblical prohibition. A woman can go to court. Our sages said, don't rejoice at a wedding of a girl who's marrying a non-learned person because he will probably beat her. And that's not a wedding to rejoice at. How could you be happy she's marrying someone who's going to beat her? Look at that. Look at how far our sages took it. So these concepts, again, we're fortunate that the world has evolved and much of the concepts of the Torah were adopted in our day. But this is the uniqueness, the beauty of the Torah. The Torah is consistent. These have been the values of the Torah since the Torah was given. The godliness of the Torah gives us consistency. Although we grow with time and we learn to apply the Torah to our day and age, but the Torah remains a constant because the Torah is truth. The Torah is the connection between what's good and what's right. A concept which modern philosophers like to overlook. And the Torah says that's the way it is. Hashem, who created the world, can tell you what's right and what's wrong. I can't tell you. No philosopher could tell you, because as we see, philosophy has evolved, and every generation thought they got it right. But the Torah can tell you. And we see one of the beauties of the Torah is the consistency of the Torah. Yes?
Two questions. One is the idea, like, once you accept all of Shemayim upon you, is the idea of Tov and Ra and, like, good and evil always clear? Or is there a gray?
Number one, when a person accepts Ol Malchut Shamayim, they have to learn. It doesn't happen on autopilot. There's a big Torah to learn. And it's only through learning Torah that we can understand what's good and bad. And secondly, even after we know all the Torah, sometimes the Torah says that there is no clear answer what's good or bad. Sometimes the Torah says it's up to you. It's not that in every situation the Torah is going to tell you, you must do A or B. Sometimes the Torah says it's up to you whether to do A or B.
So would slavery be an example of that? Maybe at one point ethical, but now it's not, is it?
I didn't say the Torah says one is maybe ethical. I didn't say that. That's a different question.
But can something change, can something ethicalness, that
this? I don't think so. I don't think the ethics of the Torah change. No.
But what's applicable to one generation can be
that deserves a broad discussion. The idea of how we evolve with time, and mitzvos become more or less relevant with time, that's a different question. But the ethic of the Torah did not change. Now, you'll ask about slavery, so that deserves its own discussion. Maybe if you remind me, in a few weeks we'll be in Parshat Shmot, in Parshat Mishpatim. So there, that's a good time to take a half hour, 45 minutes to discuss it. Maimonides has a piece on it, and Nachmanides over there in Parshat Mishpatim speaks about it a little bit. But that's a separate question which we should discuss. And if you want, we could try to discuss it this Thursday night. Just remind me. Okay? But that's a good question. Yeah?
Did you ask us both questions?
I have another. You can ask
another one. So, like, with absolute morality and ethics and things, how do we, like, reconcile or understand, like, the seemingly very harsh punishments that Jewish courts can administer to people?
I don't think it's difficult to understand the harsh punishments that the courts can administer, because the courts never administer a harsh punishment unless the person was forewarned. What you're about to do is punishable with the following punishment as it states in the Torah, and you will get that punishment. So to say that the punishments are harsh, I don't see why they're harsh when the person had a warning just before he did it. There has to be a warning a few seconds, within like 3 seconds of the action, there has to be a warning where two witnesses tell the person, you're not allowed to do this. The Torah prohibits it, and it is punishable with the following punishment. He has to hear that. So when a person was warned just before they did it, is that punishment really harsh? I don't think so.
But we're talking about like how we view morality today.
Think for a second. Imagine you're driving in the car, and there's a red light, and you're about to hit the pedal, right? You're about to ignore the red light, and the Waze comes on and says, I am the policeman watching you. And if you go through that red light, I will ticket you, and you will sit in jail for 3 days. Is it harsh if that happens afterwards?
Yeah, but that and having hot lead poured down your throat is much different.
If the person was forewarned, the person was told, if you do this, then this is punishable by death with burning. And this is the pasuk, and this is what's going to happen. He sees the two witnesses, he's forewarned. I don't see why that's so harsh. The person is told just before they do it.
Punishment can still be kind of cruel in its essence.
Why do they need to be like physically damaging punishments by Torah law?
So that's another question for Thursday night. Okay.